take a boy born and raised in New Jersey on Springsteen and a Southern California beach bum raised in the 60s, and what do you get? Do What You Like with Tom Cavanaugh and Bob Telford. Well, Tommy, we had so much fun with David Dean Bottrell that we asked him to continue with his story, and we've turned it into the second episode, and I am looking forward to it. How about you?
Yeah, this is exciting. This is only the second time we've done this, and only because it's a wealth of information. And if you're planning to get into show business, here's somebody, once again, that not only has a wealth of information, but is drenched in positivity, exactly. Drenched in being positive, does not have any bitterness in it. And if he does, he doesn't express it in that way as some of us might, including myself.
Exactly.
It's not an easy industry, and David Dean makes it look easy and tells us why it can be easy.
Right.
So please sit back and listen, and it's great that you guys are here again, and please enjoy part two of
David Dean Bottrell. So you had mentioned that the essence of that particular character was a gentleman that you had worked for that was obviously gay.
Yeah.
You are openly gay.
I am.
And in what, 2011 that you decided, and this is what really intrigues me is because I saw the show when you did it at the Rogue Machine.
Yeah.
And I was just blown away. You know, I was blown away, first of all, by the stories and knowing that all of these stories came from your life. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just fascinating because you've had how many different shows? There's been the David Dean Bottrell Makes Love. David Dean Bottrell,
Is working.
Is working. And then is there another one?
No, there was going to be another one, but that one never materialized. I'm now doing David Dean Bottrell Makes Love again, but I'm doing a new version of it. There's a lot of new stories in it.
So that came about, it's telling stories about your life, things that have happened to you, not only your romantic life, but just your working life and whatever. What prompted you to want to go do a one-man show about your life?
I'm going to go happy accident again. I started doing storytelling shows. A friend of mine took me to a storytelling show in LA. And for those of you who are listening, if you're in LA, the storytelling shows in LA are incredible.
They're phenomenal.
Because there is so much writing talent in Los Angeles. And many of them have a little time on their hands and they want to, or they are writing something that they would, you know, maybe rather not be writing, but they get in there and they have a chance to really speak. Right. And there are phenomenal shows. And so I saw a couple of those and I got intrigued that I wanted to see if I could play in that sandbox. And so I started doing those shows. And one night I did a show. There was the specifics of those shows is there's a time limit or there's a word limit on what you can do. And the show was 1500 words. And I just got intrigued about trying to tell the story about a relationship that I was in for 10 years with somebody who had a very serious alcohol and drug problem. Oh, yeah. And I thought, can I tell that in 1500 words? And so that was the challenge. And I got it into 1500 words and I did it in this pretty well-known show. And the response to it was so strong. It started out with everybody just laughing their asses off at these hijinks at the beginning of it. And by the end, I was hearing people like sniffling out there. And I could hear them. And when I left that theater that night, I thought that was kind of a thing. Like that was kind of that felt a little more like theater than just doing a story. And so as I drove home, I thought, God, how many love stories do I have? You know, different kinds of love stories. And could I actually do a show about this? And that was the germ of it, was to see if I could like had enough love stories to string together to do it. And turns out I had more than enough to do it. And the most interesting part of that process to me anyway, was it was so different than acting. Mm-hmm. The big joy of acting and what I'd always been taught to do was to disappear into it. You know, to get just completely disappear. And into the character and make it let that person be real. And this is very different because it's quite the opposite. You're not disappearing. Right. You're becoming as transparent and as honest as you can be.
That's interesting. So you're basically standing naked in front of the audience is what it
you are.
Yeah, you are.
But at the same time, the shows are highly developed. I got to watch the development over the last 2 years, pre-COVID and first year back in COVID. But also I got to see this most recent show, which is in New York running right now at the Triad Theater.
Thank you.
Here you go. And but in all honesty, there's a rhythm to the show that's different. It's not
structured
a typical one-person show. And it stands completely on your own. Do you have, I mean, you're consciously aware of this, but do you bring in a team of people? Do you have the same director? And it's a high, high quality of a show.
Thank you. The quality
of the show is extremely high. I did a year with a one-person show that won the Hollywood Fringe, and we did it from development to the, and then it ran for another year in L.A., different kind of show, though. It still was that format. Mm-hmm. There's several formats, but your show's not like any of those formats.
It's just and you up
there. Are you calling that shot all by yourself, or do you have somebody that you bounce it off of? What's the process to get it up to this quality?
Well, first of all, thank you. That's very, very kind of you. And congratulations on your show winning, because doing any kind of solo performance is quite an achievement.
Yeah.
It's a hell of a thing to try to.
And I was just the director producer, Jenny Fawn in L.A. It's her show and it's still running somewhere.
Oh, great!
It's always running somewhere. Yeah, it's just it's doing great. But it's a different experience for people that want to be actors and want to jump into a one person show. Should do the research. Most don't, and you need to break out, right? And but yours is different. It's got this amazing quality and energy. Where does it come from, and how do you funnel that into every production?
Yeah. Oh, okay. Well, all right. Thank you. That's a very nice question.
But it's true. I mean, I watched a lot of these shows, man, especially in the LA scene.
Yeah.
One person shows can be brutal.
They can. And let's be honest, those of us who have been in the business for any length of time, we've all sat through X number of pretty difficult one person shows. And that's a hard thing to pull off, you know? Yeah. And I that's why I never thought I would ever have any interest in doing it at all, ever. And again, what got me was the subject matter of love. And I thought, oh, okay. You know, and the intent was not to talk about myself. The intent was to talk about love, but how am I going to talk about love if I don't tell the truth about what happened?
Yeah. You know?
And I also discovered pretty quickly that as soon as I started writing about it, very quickly, I started telling a little more truth than I intended to tell.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And then I would look at it and go, wow, are you really going to say that? Like, are you seriously going to say that?
Some things that, when I first saw the show back in 2011, there were some things that shocked me, but in a good way. You know, you weren't using a lot of bells and whistles to make it. You were telling the truth. You were being transparent, as you said earlier.
Yeah. When I first started doing it, the very, very first night I ever did was at the Comedy Central stage, and I was terrified.
The
biggest terrifying part about it was mostly my friends in the audience. And I thought, wasn't really until that night when I was backstage and I started like running over the lines, and I thought, holy fucking shit. I'm about to go out and say all this, largely things that were pretty private out there. And I was a little afraid that nobody would be able to look me in the eye afterward, you know? And of course, it was exactly the opposite, which was everybody was like saying, oh my God, I thought I was the only one. I thought I was the only one who ever felt that way, or the only one who ever did something like that, or the only one who ever made that mistake. I was embraced for it, you know? And I will tell you that I did it for a while and I stepped away from it for quite a while and now I'm doing it again. But it's been, out of everything I've done, this is the most extraordinary personal experience that I've ever had as an artist, like ever.
And it should be too, because
thank you.
Yeah,
and I'll tell you why. Because it's not because, it's because people stay that I don't know like people I've never met in my life, stay after to speak to me. And they're not there to say, oh, you were funny on Boston Legal, or can I have a selfie, or any of that stuff. They want to tell me something out of their life. And I have been told some really heavy duty things.
You bet you can't use them all.
No. I don't even know, you know?
Yeah,
right. So it's in that sense, it's kind of a privilege to do it.
Well, it makes it sounds you made a connection with these people. And that's really important, you know. I mean, it's fascinating. But, go ahead, Tommy.
No, but also in the process, because I was lucky enough to watch it in workshop on and off different stages.
Yeah.
Something you do that you got a great eye for the edit. Not that the stuff that we saw in workshop was bad. It was that good. But when I got to the show, that was not the show I expected. I thought I had seen the show. I didn't. You're constantly reinventing yourself. And if you've been able to pull this off numerous times, how do you do that? How do you look at your own personal material and reinvent it? Because that's something I don't think I've ever seen before. And I go to a lot of workshops.
Okay. When it first was being done in LA, there were just a number of factors that were different at that time. Like I was single. I'm not now. I had been doing a lot of dating. And I really was like trying to like land somebody. I was like musical chairs. I was trying to find somebody before everybody was taken, you know? So I was really trying hard, and it was leading to a lot of stupid adventures, you know, that were going nowhere. So I had a lot of kind of material coming at me. And then also my father was still alive at the time that first show was done. Right. And my story about him has changed very dramatically now that he's gone. And so there were a couple of things like that. And when I came back to the show here in New York, I continue to do, you know, spoken word shows. And every once in a while, something I think, oh, that could fit in the show. And I started really telling stories that were a little darker, actually.
Character. And I've noticed that in the more recent version that I saw before the COVID that you did over there.
Yeah.
At that was the one on Lancashire. I can't remember.
Yeah, Acme, which is sadly no longer there.
And it was fascinating, because having seen the first time around and then seeing it again, I was like, wow. I mean, there was some that was still, you know, there was recognizable from the first show. But it's fascinating how you're able to continue to develop and change the show.
Yeah, how do you get it to the right now, the show that's running? How did you I mean, you take a knife to it. How do you do it?
I'm going to say it's kind of the same principle as clothing, you know? Sometimes something doesn't fit anymore and you can just feel it. You can feel it when it doesn't fit any longer. And then there were just things that I felt like I kind of outgrown. You know, certain jokes or certain stories. And I thought, well, that's kind of, you know, I don't know. I think we've kind of heard that already, or the times have changed a little better, or people are, or I guess I'm a little heavier than I used to be. And when I first brought it to LA, the version that Bob is talking about, which is yet different than the one I'm doing now.
Oh, really?
It became, I don't know. I guess the best answer is I could just sort of feel the constriction of it a little bit. And I thought, geez, I think this is really no longer as true as it could be.
Do you think it's like the same development that a stand-up does, where they go out and they feel, probably. All right, this works, this doesn't work.
Probably.
That's a good way of looking at it.
I can tell you, I mean, back to something you asked before, I have had a terrible time with the idea of the one man show thing, because I thought I've never desired to be on stage by myself. I've never wanted to be a stand up. But once I started doing this, I would be very scared. And I would think, David, they're not really here to see you. They're here to hear the story. So just go out there and start talking. And the stories are the star of the show, not you. The stories are the star of the show. So you just put that out front and it'll all be okay. And it has been. And, you know, I had a similar experience when I was writing the book, because about halfway through, I had a big crisis and I thought, who the fuck am I to write this book? Do you mean like, I'm not famous. Like, why should anybody fucking listen to me?
Sure.
And then I suddenly thought, well, this book is not actually about being famous. It's about not being famous. You know, it's about like having a career and having a life and being an artist. And don't worry about whether your name is above the title. And suddenly I thought, who the fuck am I to not write this book?
Exactly. You allowed yourself the luxury to say, we all have it in us, so I'm going to do it.
Why not? Yeah. I've done all this other shit. Why not? I'll write this book.
Yeah.
But anyway, I guess I'm going to go back to another thing that really sounds stupid, I guess. But I've always, like a lot of people, thought, oh, I'm really walking a kind of a fine line here when I'm out in front of this audience, or I'm in front of this camera, or I'm in front of these executives that I'm pitching a story to. And I've got to really make sure that there's nothing in here that's boring or beside the point or whatever. I've got to keep it like right on the line all the time and make sure that there's nothing extra or nothing that they're going to get bored with. Because if I made a joke about me having a short attention span, will you pitch to entertainment executives? It's extremely short attention span. So you got to keep, it's all got to be, you know, a straight line and everybody can follow it. And we're going somewhere. We're going somewhere. Trust me, I'll get us there. I think that's the best answer.
It's fascinating because you have that do it yourself attitude, which leads me to the next highlight of, at least in my mind, of your career. And that is that you created and co-produced SciFest in LA.
And
I was fortunate enough to be involved in two different occasions, one of which, and I don't know if I've shared this with you, Tom, David says to me one day, he goes, Bob, doing this play, it's part of the SciFest, and I need somebody to understudy me. And I just about fell off my chair.
Of course.
Because you have to understand something. You know, I studied with David for a while, and I, for lack of a better word, I idolized David as an artist. And so to have him come up and say to me,
of course, hey,
I want, now here's the other part of it that I really appreciated from, he says, I want you to understudy me, but just know you're never going to go on.
At least he's honest. Hey, yeah. let me tell you something else. As a writer that was in LA at the time, SciFest was a hot
ticket. How did that come about?
Oh, every writer wanted, and so the audience that doesn't know what SciFest was.
Because he had people, he had actors you know, from Star Trek, Walking Dead, Supernatural,
Lost.
Take
it back a little bit. They announced to the writers, open submission.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. One-act plays that are sci-fi, and we will cast it with people from TV and movie sci-fi legends.
Yeah.
Right.
And people, oh, it lit up. Everybody and their brother was writing sci-fi. Every workshop you were in saw 10, 15 sci-fi pieces a month because everybody wanted to be in sci-fi.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Yeah, it was such an exciting time.
Talk about that. How did that all happen?
It had happened again. I'm going to go with a happy accident in a way, because I'm a fan of short stories. I like short stories. And I happened to be reading a collection, and there was a story in it by Ursula Le Guin, Le Guin. And it was called The Wife's Story or The Wife's Tale or something like that. Mm-hmm. And it was just a first person narrative. And it was this kind of creepy story. It wasn't terribly long, but it was this kind of creepy story being told by this woman. And when you get, not to spoil it, but when you get to the end of it, you discover that what you thought she was talking about is not what she was talking about. And she's actually talking about something horrifying, terrifying. And even right now, I just got chill bumps when I thought about it, because it was just so well written. And I thought, holy shit, I wonder if I could like put like the right actress on stage.
I think you used that piece too. What was
I did. I did. It was in the first festival.
What was her name?
L. Scott Caldwell.
Yes. And she was awesome in that. That show, the first season, and you did this, you co-produced this with Lee Costello, who I ended up working for. She had me on her short list after, I don't know how it happened too, but you know, all of a sudden, and she's a sweetheart. I love her.
Oh gosh, she's great.
So, but anyway, you had that piece, which I saw, and then you had, I mean, there were some incredible pieces.
Yes. Yeah.
And the actors, the lineup of actors, it was just, I was like, this is phenomenal.
Well, you know what? That little moment when I read that, I thought, God, what if that could be, you know, on stage? And then I thought, gee, what if there was an entire festival of these like little mini Twilight Zone episodes? And then I sat on that idea for a year for this reason, because it seemed like it was beyond me. Like, I thought, that's too big. That's what a circus that would be. Right. And like, however the money come from, and who would do this and who would do that. And I haven't really ever produced on that like that before. And I just sat on it. And after a year, I thought, it just kept coming back. And I thought, that's a great idea. And nobody's done it.
Yeah.
And so I thought, okay, I have an address book, you know, I have an email list. I'm going to start talking to people. I'm going to just start asking this question. Who knows how to do this? Who knows how to do that? And I found these two remarkable producing partners. And it was a remarkable equation between the three of us. Like, what we never really had a problem. Like, it went so smooth.
So how did you put out the call, the scripts come in. How many scripts came in and how did you get through them to pick that first slate?
Again, miraculously. Lee Costello loves reading scripts.
Yes.
I do not. But Lee Costello is happy with a pile of scripts in front of her. She loves that. And she knew other people who loved that. And we just got some volunteers to sort. Because we got, I forget how many we got the first year. I think it may be like 300 scripts.
I think that's what you told me at one time was 300. Yeah. And then by the time we finished,
which was 3 years later, I think we got like, it was 800 or 900 we got the last year. It was an incredible amount. And we just kind of divided up the jobs. And I said, I don't really have the attention span to do this. So I'll just read the finalists, you know, and I completely trusted Lee. She has impeccable taste. And then she brought some other people and we would just narrow it down to the stack that we thought maybe we could do. And it was very tough because, you know, sometimes this was this year's festival and you can't produce three stories about androids. You know what I mean? Like there had to be one. You had to pick the best android play of that year and then the best whatever. And then I actually wrote a couple. I mean, I knew a little bit about producing 1X because I'd seen it done at EST here in New York very successfully. And I knew that you had to kind of had like at the end of the first act, you had to grab them. Like you had to get really something to get them back after the intermission. Mm-hmm. And a couple of years we didn't have that. And so I actually wrote things that we produced, but I didn't put my name on them because I put a pen name on it because I didn't want to offend people that I turned down. And I didn't want them to say, oh, well, he just produces his own stuff. So I just kind of snuck one in there without anybody knowing it.
But you needed to grab her. You need to keep the audience from coming back. You know, you need to keep them to come back.
Yeah. And we kind of, so one of the things that was hard was scary plays. Like a lot of them are really interesting and mind blowing and weird and wonderful, but like this, we didn't get a lot of scary stuff. And I knew we had to have at least like a scary one to get to like jolt them a little bit. So I mostly wrote scary things for that.
Great.
And Bob, I was so nervous to ask you about that. I felt so guilty about that because you're a wonderful actor. And I thought, oh my God, Bob's not going to do this. He's going to be offended. And you were so gracious about it. Thank you so much.
Can I tell you something, David? I have adopted your philosophy and Tom knows this. I say yes to everything.
Right.
You know, because I figure if I don't know how to do it, I'll figure out how to do it. And yet, you know, it's funny that you mentioned that because one of the things that I've always admired about you is that willingness to go out there and take those risks. And I have to wonder if at any point does fear ever get to the point where it's just so great you can't ignore it? I mean, does it ever get in your way?
Yes. Yes, it does. It's my constant companion, Bob.
I mean, I know for me, there are times Tom's told me, oh, there he goes again, you know, and I have this rhythm beginning before the show, during the show, and after the show, the run of these shows. I'm in a mindset in the beginning. I'm in a mindset during. And then I'm in the funk after.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, but it's that fear is always there. Will it ever happen again? Will I ever be able to rise to the occasion? So you experience that?
Yeah, sure. Sure. I mean, in a way, I hate to say this because I'd like to live a life that's free of fear, but I kind of think it's part of the equation a little bit, you know? I think I've done some of my best stuff because
you need that
at the last minute. Fear was a great motivating force to get it finished or to make it work or to do whatever it is. And I've also started, and this didn't, you know, this is obviously, it took a while to get to this place, but when I was directing this play, I learned a big lesson about fear because I had this kind of massive text that I had to make interesting, and it was not super interesting, truthfully. Right. And I would be driving to rehearsal and I would think, Jesus, what am I going to do with that? You know, there was a lot of shit happening at that time. I was doing 8 things at that time I was directing this play. And what am I going to do with that big boring stretch in the second act? That scene is so boring. What am I going to do? And I would be driving out there and I'd feel very panicked about it. And I would think, you know what? You'll figure it out when you're in the rehearsal hall. You're not going to figure it out in this car.
Right.
It's going to happen when you get there and the actors are there and everybody's working. And if you don't have an idea, one of the actors is going to have an idea, or the designers are going to have an idea. Somebody's going to have an idea and we will figure this out.
Sure.
And it's that never failed me. Like once I got to the actual workplace and was with my fellow artists, somebody sparked something, which sparked something, and we figured it out, you know, and it was not boring. We solved it. Right. And so that was a great reminder to me. Like when I panic and I think I'm never going to work again, I think, oh yes, you will. I mean, you're going to have to wait because everybody has to wait, but you're going to work again. You're going to work again. It'll come back around. Somebody will knock on the door. And, you know, I just did something a couple of weeks ago on the new Law and Order.
I saw you had posted that you had booked that and done that. And I think that's fantastic. So you obviously love what you're doing because you have immersed yourself in this business, not only as an actor, but as a writer, as a director, as a producer. And then on top of all those, you teach. So you started teaching, and I think you started teaching at the American Academy before UCLA. You were doing the American Academy in LA.
Yeah.
Then you did UCLA, and then you went to New York. But now, even with COVID, you're saying, I know what I can do. And so you're doing like online auditioning workshops, because when I studied with you, it was in person, various locations. I had, that was the great joy of studying with you is where are we doing it this week? And it wasn't bad. I mean, there was that great little studio down there below Pico.
Yeah.
I first started, and then we went to the Acme, and we were upstairs and that, and then, I mean, and then we were in that,
the green room.
Oh my God. When I first walked in there, it's like, and Tom, you have to imagine this. It was a green screen psych all the way around.
Wow. So it was a huge green screen.
When you turn the lights on, everybody had this hue about them. But interestingly enough, the space created this sort of, it was unlike any place I'd ever worked before.
You're on
this, you know, it's sort of this, I don't know what you'd call it. It's like a, you know, viral thing or not viral, virtual. That's the word, virtual.
Yeah.
And it was fascinating. But the thing is that you've always found a way to stay in the business and stay busy doing what you like.
Yeah.
You know, which I think that's wonderful. So, currently, are you still teaching for the American Academy?
I am. Actually, I taught there this afternoon.
Good. And then you're doing the online stuff.
I do. And during COVID, I also taught for UCLA again, and I also taught for USC a little bit online.
And so as a teacher, what do you tell your students? You know, because obviously they want to pursue a career in this business. They come and they want to learn from you like they'll learn from all of the other teachers in that department or whatever. What do you tell them? Because I know when I studied, we had conversations as a group and individually and whatnot. But what is it that you're telling? Because I think our audience needs to hear this, because it's important not only to teach the art of acting, it's to teach the business, which, by the way, the working actor, you know, everybody should have a copy of that,
you
know, on their bookshelf, because it's fascinating. The read, it's actually not done the way most books on acting are done.
No.
And so back to the question that I posed to you, which is, what do you tell your students, if that want to get in this business? What is your advice to them?
Well, it's, obviously I have so many pieces of advice depending exactly what we're talking about. But The big one that I guess would sum it all up,
right,
is I say, if you want to work, if you want to be hired in this business, it really comes down to the quality of your imagination and your ability to access it. I think that's if you want to be an actor or a writer or a director or a composer or a choreographer, any of it kind of boils down to that. And I think that your imagination is a living, breathing thing. It's like a houseplant. You got to take care of it.
Right.
And you got to make sure it's got water and light and, air and what it needs so it can grow.
Right.
And you got to feed it. You got to sort of find things. You got to take things in.
Yeah.
And you might remember how much I used to harp on listening. But the other thing is, I sort of say, is we've gotten into a very weird chapter of our existence as human beings where we can literally kind of filter our lives, like with electronics. We can sort of say, oh, this is my feed. I'm only going to listen to this, and I'm only going to watch this, and I'm going to kind of close out everything that I don't, and I can walk down the street and listen to my own music, and like, I can create my reality to some extent. You can sort of decide it. And I think that, if that's what's happening in the world, then that's what's happening. I can't control that. But I do tell my students who want to be artists, that's a terrible policy to be an artist. You're literally kind of blocking life. You're blocking the world that's out there. You're blocking all these experiences, both positive and negative, that you're going to have to that. But if you want to be an artist, someone's going to want to know your opinion about something. They're going to want to know your impression. They're going to want to see you change when you encounter something that you like or don't like. And you got to know how to do that. That takes practice if you don't have that naturally. And all that stuff, all as much as I love my phone, it can also be kind of not good for us.
Oh, too, I know. It's so fascinating when you go into, like, I went up north a week or so ago, and I was in an elevator of a hotel, and four people got on the elevator, and every single one of them was staring down at their phone.
Yeah.
And so it's like this world that we've created with the technology where we've isolated ourselves. And it's unfortunate because, and Tom, you have experienced this firsthand, the difference in terms of younger people and their behavior. They don't have the same social skills that we have, that kind of thing. And it's really sad because, as an artist, you do have to open yourself. And the other thing you mentioned in one of the classes was getting them in the room, knowing how to grab them in the room, I think any advice on that?
Well, what changed my life as an actor was when I was a young actor, I used to think that I was going into an audition to give a performance of some kind.
Right.
And that I would work very hard on my performance, and I would come in and I would try to show this, whoever this was I was auditioning for, that I was a brilliant actor and I could play every emotion in the rainbow in these three pages. I could laugh, I could cry, I could get angry, I could do everything in these three pages of this I could just act the shit out of it. And I remember that was my first, forays into auditioning. And I do remember when a casting director stopped me one time and said, "Hey, would you do me a favor? Would you just like not do any of that? And would you just do like what this character is doing?"
Right.
And it was talk about the moment of nakedness. I was like, oh, okay. All right. Yeah, and I did it. And I felt it immediately. I thought, oh my God, like, I don't feel like I'm acting. Like I don't feel like I'm giving a big performance.
It's like a truthfulness that's coming out.
Well, I was doing what the person in the script was trying to do. It came down to that. I was just doing what they were trying to do.
Right.
And that's another thing that I teach quite a bit with the students is in acting school, it's very exploratory. We can try all kinds of things and all kinds of different approaches. But when it comes down to auditioning, it's not exactly a job interview, because that's not really quite what it is as an experience.
Yeah.
But there is a job that needs to be done. And the job is, they're looking for somebody who understands what happens in this scene and can make that happen, like right here, right now, whatever it is, if it's a divorce or a breakup or a negotiation or a whatever it is, or a seduction or a lie or whatever it is that's occurring in this scene. Can you do that? Because that's all they want to know. Can you do that? Can you do that truthfully? Can you make that appear to be happening in this room right now? And that has a way of simplifying it a little bit for people. And the other thing that I tell people, which is, I wish I had known this from day one, but it took me years to learn it, is that I never really think about auditioning as auditioning. I think of it as, okay, you want to see me play this role? I'm going to play this role. And so this is a free sample of my work. This is what I do.
It's a good attitude.
This is, you know, this one's free. If you want more, you'll have to pay for it. But this one is free. And like all people who work in retail know, if you're in a retail thing and you're going to get free samples, you do not give the worst, oldest, dustiest sample from the back of the warehouse.
You want them to buy something. So
right. You're going to give them quality material.
Right. Right.
And so I always think of this is, if you hire me, this is what I will do. I will do this on your set next week. It will be no better. It will be no worse than what you're going to see right now.
At least you know what you're getting. So you're doing the show there in New York, David Dean Cottrell Makes Love. And you're coming to LA with it, right?
I am. I'm coming to LA.
Any chance you're coming to Ventura? You know, I should get the power. I should get the powers that be to get you booked up here as well. So, you know,
that would be awesome. I love it.
I tell you, they got a great venue up here, and I think your show would be a hit up here.
I wish. I'd love to come to Ventura. I love Ventura.
What's the future hold for David Dean Bottrell and his Making Love and David Dean Bottrell Works?
We'll soon know. I mean, I'm doing the show here in New York until June 1st.
Right.
And I am hoping.
And where are you doing that show? Where are you doing it?
Oh, I'm doing it at the Triad Theater on West 72nd Street.
Really good space. And,
thank you. Thank you so much. It's a great space. It's really terrific for the show. I've never done the show in a cabaret space before, and I love it.
Oh, yeah.
I was terrified of it at first, but I love it now. It is lovely to interact in the way that we interact in the show. So it's very different than doing it in a theater. Right. But anyway, and if anybody wants information about that, it's triadnyc.com. I play there on Wednesday nights, and we finish up on the 1st of June, unless there's a big, we're going to have to.
Is that the same site that you get tickets on?
Yeah. Yeah. Triadnyc.com.
There you go. So if you need tickets for that. Now, somebody wants to. When they get to LA, do you know the venue yet, or we don't?
I do. It's the White Fire Theater. The White
Fire. Get Brian Rasmussen.
My favorite.
He's a good egg. Yeah, yeah, he's a very good egg. And
he's been on the show.
It's my first time to perform there, so I'm looking forward to it.
Excellent.
And there are four shows. They're kind of spread out, but the first one is on the 12th of June. So I'm there for 2 weeks, but I've got four shows, but they're at odd different times because the theater is booked for various things. And it's actually an industry showcase of the show because I have new representation as a writer in Los Angeles, and we're going to try to maybe sell some TV stuff.
Good idea.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see what happens. I've been around long enough to,
sometimes things don't happen the way you meant them to.
Yeah, you never know. And I actually have for 2 years now been thinking about a novel that I want to write.
Wow.
That's a very funny, very dark novel. Again, based on something that very recently happened in my family, just when I thought they didn't have any more tricks up their sleeve.
I was just going to say, what a wealth of material they have provided you.
Oh my God. It's worth its weight in gold. But there is something that happened a few years ago that is terribly dark, really, truthfully, and also terribly funny if you're in the right mood. And I've been thinking about it quite a bit for 2 years now. And so as soon as I get back from California, I'm carving out the time to write a novel because I've never done that before. I've written everything else. Might as well try a novel.
Yeah.
So I'm going to give it a whirl, and I'm going to try to get the show back up or move it somewhere or try to get it to San Francisco or try to do something with it.
Yeah, you should be able to travel with that bad boy. You should be able to get it. You know, I mean, it's difficult You know who she, you know who he should get in touch with is Raquel, theater planners, maybe, because she does shows all over. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay. That's a good one to talk to.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, I just think it's fantastic. And I think it's a shame that, that, you know, only people in New York and LA are able to witness the genius. So, so Tom was about to ask you, all of the particulars with regards to getting in touch with David Dean Bottrell and finding out more
about
him and his book. And
right. How do you get the book? How do you, if I want to see, get into the video acting class, how do we do this?
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, the best bet for when I'm teaching the classes, the private classes, is to follow me online. And that's easy to do. I'm on the major ones. I'm on Facebook, I'm on Twitter, and I'm on Instagram. And just, there's nobody else with my name, David Dean Bottrell. I'm not hard to find.
Yes.
On those platforms.
There's only one.
There's only one. But I'm usually, I advertise the classes there and they fill up pretty fast, which is great. And so, but if you follow me there, you'll probably see it. And, but I don't have a specific site because I do it at different, like sometimes I'm doing
it.
Do
you have your website? Don't you have your David Dean?
I do have a website, but I'm not great at keeping it updated. I'm going to be honest about that. If you want to learn more about the book, there is a website for the book, which is workingactorthebook.com.
It's a great read. It's working. A great read.
Thank you.
I will say, Bob. You know, I it was fascinating when you had the book signing there at Barnes & Noble.
Oh, yeah, in L.A. That was so much fun.
With, oh, Christ, his name.
With Alfred Molina.
I was blown away. It's like, oh. Alfred Molina is going to come up and do the interview. And I was like,
yeah,
it doesn't get any better than that. And the whole group, this is the thing that I have to tell you, the whole group was like totally, you know, on the edge of their seats, listening to every word. It was fascinating. And everybody wanted to stick around afterwards. And of course I have my signed copy.
Thank you, Bob.
But no, it's I think it's really amazing how you've tapped into this, the essence of what it means to be an artist. And you're sharing that with everybody. Not only are you doing it, you know, and doing it brilliantly, but you're also saying, look, I can help you if you'd like to learn more, and through the book, through the classes, whatever. And I just think it's awesome that you are doing all of that.
Thank you.
And the fact that you were able to come on and join us here on Do What You Like, you know, I mean, doesn't get any better than that.
It's wonderful. You know, thank you.
Is there anything that Tom and I have missed? Because if so,
I don't know. It seems pretty thorough.
We both admire you, and we both, you know, enjoy what you
definitely enjoy what you do.
You really, and we know how important it is for our audience to be able to you know, get a little you know, piece of that. So
I can tell you one last thing.
We want to make sure we don't. What's that?
Well, one last thing I'd like to share, because this is something we all three have in common.
Woo-hoo!
Is that all three of us recently relocated.
Yep. You know?
Yes. And that was a very big decision to do that. And it seemed terribly risky at the time. You know, I every alarm bell was going off saying, don't do that. Don't do that. You can't afford it. There's no work there. They won't work out. This is not going to work out. You can't. And it really took me 2 years of really kind of work. I hired a therapist to get out of LA because I felt like I was trapped. Like I couldn't find a door. I couldn't find an exit, you know?
Yeah.
And I actually hired
him. And we all were there. I was there too. I'm not happy in my survival job.
Right.
And you know, the industry had come to like a weird standstill for a while.
Right.
Couldn't get a script at the door. I'm like, I got to make a move. And I had, my therapist is my brother. God bless him.
God bless him.
I didn't have a therapist. I just ran.
Good for you. You're brave.
You're right. You're right.
Well, I'm hoping that, you know, I hope that I have that same, you know, I get the same results that you did, and that it doesn't take 2 years, you know, because I'm not a big waiter, you know.
But here, let me ask you this question. Just.
Yeah. Tommy, you didn't get in your favorite question. I'm surprised. I'm shocked.
Because he's one of the only guests that told us these were the hard times.
Yeah. Tommy always likes to say, okay, we hear all the things you love about this. What don't you? And
oh,
you
sure.
share that. So your honesty, you were upfront about it, which is great because I think a lot of people, they, you know, I heard a lot of this, you know what? I think I might try acting. And I go, really? You know, you got
that right. That's you know, usually a lot of times veterans will shun it when they hear somebody's like wants to get into it because, you know, no matter what person you talk to, it was always better when they started. Doesn't matter what time in theater history or show business history, it was always better when they started.
Oh yeah, you'll and never.
You should have done this.
Yeah,
you always, I don't know.
What do you tell people? Because you're a positive guy, it's got to be a different message. Yeah. But what do you tell people, especially that, like right now, people are walking away from their jobs and they want to chase that dream? What do you tell them?
Yeah, you got to have that little Surgeon General message on the side of the cigarette pack.
You
warning:
you
this
do.
Job will.
You do. I mean, there are. You know, I one of the things I talk about in the book is, you know, you got to have your eyes and ears open when you start this. Because a lot of many are called, you know, and but you got to sort of see if it fits, you know, if it fits you, because it's a gambling business. And if you're not a gambler, this is maybe not a good feel for you. And you also got to pay attention, not just to how what you want and how you feel about it and how you, you know, what your goals are, or what your feelings are about it. But how do people respond to what you do?
Good for you.
Do they say, wow, that's terrific. What are you doing next? Or do they kind of run the other direction and try to avoid you or there's not a lot of compliments coming your way about the actual work you do. And if that's the case, you might be a wonderful artist, but maybe not as an actor.
Yeah.
Maybe there's something else you could do that'd be really fulfilling and wonderful for you.
Well,
but it's a very particular thing.
Yeah,
it is really particular.
Yeah. You know, go ahead, Tom. Go ahead.
No. I mean, he hit it. But now you reinvented yourself and you're saying 2 years later, you feel comfortable again? Because I feel like momentum is starting to pick up for me and it's been about 3 years. How do you feel?
It's been great for me. Good. I mean, and part of that is personal as well, because I had gone through a couple of terrible marriages in LA and I did not feel like, and this is part of the culture of Los Angeles. It's not just Hollywood. It's the city itself. There's a culture of youth.
Yeah,
in Los Angeles, and so it the older you become, you the less interesting you seem to be in that society, and so I was feeling like I had kind of passed my expiration date in a lot of ways, you know, and I began to feel like, and I didn't think I was ever going to remarry, that I was going to meet anybody in Los Angeles, and I thought I don't really feel that way about myself, but this city is making me feel this way about myself. Yeah. And that was one of the other motivating factors where I thought, you know what, I'm going to take my little dog and pony show and go to New York. And I was a little tired of playing murderers on television. Sure. And I thought, maybe there's something else I could play besides murderers, guest murderers. And I just brought the whole story here. And within a year, I met somebody. And we've been together for 4.5 years now. And it's been a wonderful experience.
That's awesome.
It's been just amazing. Like, it's so lovely, unexpected, great thing. So that's been a real plus of moving here. And now his work is now completely online. It's moved as many jobs.
Wow, have that's great.
And so now there is the possibility, yet again, that I may be able to do a split, like half the year here, half the year there. Because I do, between you and me, I do miss some of the money that I made in Los Angeles.
Of course.
Because I haven't exactly like, you know, cleaned up here financially. And that could change at any moment. But at the moment, I sort of thought, maybe I'll sort of try to do a little bit of both. Right. So we'll see what happens.
Well, good. Right. Well,
great stuff.
We are truly blessed to have you here.
Yeah, great.
Do what
you
like.
So great interview.
And I, you know, I can't tell you how much, you know, I've enjoyed this conversation
and
every part of the relationship that I've enjoyed with you over the years. And we thank you. And it's just so nice to be able to see you again and see how you're flourishing. You never seem to fade away. So I don't care what LA says about aging out. David Dean Bottrell is here and he's here to stay. So get used to it. Anyway, thank you, David.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
What you, like.
You guys are two big favorites
and
of
listeners,
mine.
Listeners, go see that show. Go see
David Dean Bottrell Makes Love at, what's the theater again?
Triad Theater.
Got to go see that show. And when it comes to L.A., I'm going to have
see it at the Wi-Fi.
I have to figure out how I get my butt down there and see it because I will not miss it.
Please do. Guys, thank you so much. Thank you so much. Really,
thank you. Thank you. This has been awesome.
All right. Good night, guys. Thanks so much. I'll see you soon.